Voices and Views is brought to you in part by Advanced Litho Printing, with over 60 years of excellence in printing. From the smallest job to the largest jobs and anything in between, Advanced Litho has everything you need printing related. Advanced Litho is family owned and Great Falls based. To find out more about all they offer, go to advancedlithoprinting.com or call them at 406-453-0393. And we thank them for supporting local public radio on KGPR. Welcome to Voices and Views on Great Falls Public Radio, KGPR 89.9. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of interviewing Jerry Jennings, community activist, as well as Arlene Reichert, the bridge lady, but today, the Montana Constitution lady. So welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you, Thomas.
And something I like to do with all of my guests is I think in our country, we're developing what I term a culture of contempt. And it's, we just see folks through a very narrow, shallow of things that they support or oppose. And we don't get down to who they are as a person, what their values are. And I think that that's key to us being able to collaborate as citizens and accomplish wonderful things together. So I want to start out by asking you, Arlene, very quickly, where were you born and what are some childhood experiences that were foundational to building who you are today and how you've lived your life?
Well, I was born in Buffalo, New York in 1926, so 96 years ago, and I was a child of the Depression, and that did influence me, and also a child of the Second World War and how depressing that was. And so I really grew up with a lot of outside concerns. And my mother was such a serious voter. Women got the right to vote in 1920, and she was just old enough then to vote. And she never missed an election. She said, "You may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you." And we could see how government was affecting us, you know, in every way. So I had an early interest in politics. Even when I was 12 years old, I remember clipping articles by people regarding the Second World War and whether we were going to be coming involved. So I was affected by the times.
Such a seminal time in American history. And, you know, you see that seed is planted, right, that you can make a difference. And boy, have you, you know, kind of lived that, and it's really blossomed into, you know, a lot of incredible accomplishments. So Jerry, where were you born and a little bit about your childhood?
Well, I was born in 1940, so I'm the youngster here. I was born in Rochester, New York, which is just a, you know, hop, skip, and a jump away from Buffalo, and in a family of one boy and five girls. Now, my mother was quite an athlete, so we all did athletics. And I think the biggest disappointment in my entire life is not being born after Title IX was instituted so that we could have interscholastic and intercollegiate sports. I always wanted to do that. But like Arlene, I was from, my mother was not political. My mother was the one who got us outside doing things. But my brother was. And so we listened to the Army McCarthy hearings, and we listened to the Korean War on the radio, all of us with our ears right there. And so I would say that community activism came naturally to me.
Speaking of community activism, Jerry, can you tell us a little bit about the Great Falls Rising program that's going to be coming up here on February 23rd, highlighting the 1972 Montana Constitutional Convention?
I sure can. I want to tell you first about Great Falls Rising, because this started 5 years ago, And it's a nonpartisan progressive movement that empowers individuals and connects communities while fostering equality, diversity, human rights, civil liberties, and a sustainable future through respectful dialogue, education, and advocacy. And you can see how much we need that today. So it was probably a couple months ago, Arlene and I were talking, and up came the concept of the 1972 Constitutional Convention and the fact that it is 50 years old this year. So we really got our heads together, and we've met several times about this, and decided that we, Great Falls Rising, needed to put on a program about the convention. Now, the expert is Arlene. The organizer is Jerry. Not that she's not an organizer, believe me. But we decided that we would have delegates from the convention who are, there aren't too many still alive, but there are some around. And I didn't know any of the delegates, but boy, do I feel like I know them now after talking to them on the phone and so forth. But Arlene gave me all the names and what parts they should play and so forth. And then some of the people who were actively involved with making this work at the time. All we're talking about today is the 1972, from say 69 to 75. We're not talking about what's going on today. So we put out an agenda with these folks, and we have five delegates. We have two former state legislators. We have the president of the Montana League of Women Voters. And of course, Arlene is one of the delegates, so she will be telling you about that. And we have and a historian. So we've put together quite an agenda for that night. It's February 23rd. It's a Wednesday night at 6 p.m. We're allowing 2 hours for this. And we will not even do questions and answers at the end, because the people speaking will speak for themselves and for the time.
Where will it be located?
Oh, it's going to be on Zoom. And we'll be sending it out. We'll send it out to people who are on our email list for Great Falls Rising. And then we'll spread it out to people from the League of Women Voters and so forth. So I think we'll have a pretty good audience that night.
Absolutely. And people can find Great Falls Rising, more information about it on your website.
Yes. Great. All one word. GreatFallsRisingMT.org. And we are recording it. So anyone who can't get on, we'll send out the link for the recording the next day. So I think that kind of sums it up a little bit, and Arlene will have a lot to add to it.
That sets it up perfectly. So Arlene, I think of this time period in American history, right, that 69 to 75, right? You've got Vietnam, you've had the civil rights movement going on, you have women's rights. And so I know, you know, that's the push for the Equal Rights Amendment is coming at that time period. So much is going on. And you were a delegate and a driving force. Sort of give me background on how you even got this organized to have a convention.
Well, we were stuck with the 1889 Constitution, and that was written so we could become a state. I mean, it was mandatory. In order to become a state, you had to do the Constitution. And so I found out subsequently it was copied from other state constitutions, Colorado mainly, and it left a great deal to be desired. And I became personally interested as a member of the League of Women Voters. The League was one of the driving forces for the Constitutional Convention, because we knew firsthand about the criticism that was being leveled for years about the 1889 Constitution's shortcomings. We realized the biggest problem of the old document was it authorized secret meetings, secret votes, and, you know, people didn't know what was going on. And as a member of the League, those early days, I was on the state board, we would travel to Helena, the state board, and we'd attend legislative committee hearings, and it was so distressing because we'd go to find out what was going on, and we were allowed to sit in the committee room while they chatted and discussed, but the minute a vote came up, they would say, executive session, everybody out of the room, not just the League members, but people who were there to testify for hearings, and also the journalists, everybody. Nobody was allowed in the room except the legislators. As a result, all the votes were secret. We didn't know what was going on during the legislature. And it didn't seem right because it affected all of us. So not only did we become involved, but many other groups. Among them was the Legislative Council. They were hired by the legislature as researchers to see what was going on and how it could be improved. So the point is that there was a movement, a strong movement, to open it up to the public. And so we knew that to accomplish that, we had to make the Constitution Convention accessible and open to all. You know, we had hundreds of citizen suggestions, and everything was public, and all public hearings were publicized. But I'm going off on a tangent to get back to your question. So what happened then when the League was interested and other groups, the Legislative Council, they studied it, and they were researchers, and they concluded that substantial revision and improvement was needed to provide for an active, dynamic government. And the council said it found constitutional provisions would actually invite subterfuge. It was archaic, ambiguous, and it was just so much unnecessary verbiage. It was a very long document. However, the council members could not agree on any best method of revising it. They finally concluded that the legislature should establish a constitutional revision commission to study it. So in 1969, I know some of the legislators who were involved, some of them are going to be involved in our discussion on the 23rd. The 1969 legislature established a revision commission, but it also decided at the same time, they were pretty wise, they asked the people in a 1970 general election referendum if they wanted a constitutional convention. Because it was so hard to revise the Constitution without going all the way. Anyhow, the 16-member Revision Commission began its study, and they had a few problems. They decided that revision was such an enormous task, it could only be accomplished through a Constitution Convention. So they stopped drafting, and they started pushing for a favorable vote on the referendum. See, they decided to have a referendum, and it went to the people. And in June of 70, still another group was organized. That was a broad-based, bipartisan Montana Constitutional Convention Committee. It was another group which plugged for passage of the referendum to call the convention. And the people agreed. Referendum 67 was approved by the overwhelming margin, 2-1. And so then we knew we were going to have a constitutional convention. So I guess I answered the first question that Jerry had, is how did it come about? It came about through a lot of people, a lot of groups, and I'm so pleased that the League of Women Voters was instrumental in helping it get off the ground. But there were a lot of other people. People all over the state were unhappy.
Absolutely.
We had the constitutional convention.
And I love that, you know, you talk a lot about the disinfectant of sunlight. You hear that, and transparency and accountability. You know, there is no accountability without transparency. And that's such a visceral representation of the lack of transparency when you're literally thrown out of the room when the decisions are being made, when that's most important to be present. So we've got the overwhelming passage of the referendum. And so now we're going to form this constitutional convention. So how did they select delegates? And then how many eventual delegates made up, you know, who would be doing this enormous task of developing a constitution? It's awe-inspiring.
That's an excellent question, Tom, because it was the key. There were to be 100 elected delegates, and one of the things the Supreme Court mentioned, some people think that idea originated with the Supreme Court at that time, but actually that was one of the few good things of the old Constitution. They said when you have a constitutional convention, you shouldn't have elected people. And so that was great because you couldn't be a legislator and you couldn't be an elected official of any kind. So we had a group of 100 people elected who were not really involved. Some of them had been led in the legislature a few before, but the point was we were fresh faces and we had a lot of enthusiasm. And so the 100 of us gathered in that beautiful, beautiful legislative chamber. It's where the legislature meets now. And it's where we met for the Constitutional Convention. And it's where they have that beautiful Charlie Russell mural on the wall. It's Lewis and Clark meet with the Salish. And it's such a majestic mural, and it's such a beautiful setting. But the two events to me, the Constitutional Convention and the legislature, which I served in subsequently, no comparison, completely different. And I think the main reason all people talk about for our what happened with the delegates is we had an orientation session in November. The convention actually started in January, but we met in November to set the rules and things. And the first thing we decided, let's just sit alphabetically. Well, that was unheard of. And the legislature to this day still sits, seated with one party on the one side, one on the other. It's so confrontational. And it just doesn't bode well for good legislation as far as I'm concerned. But sitting alphabetically, we just decided we were going to talk about issues.
You've brought up some great points. First, the alphabetical. I think that is so true that in our politics writ large, you see that folks, they don't break bread together. They don't have any idea who the people are that are on, quote, the other side of the aisle. And I love those are little reforms you can think of that would be simple, but could be really impactful, is just to have people sit alphabetically, not by seniority, not by party. And I love that you guys came with that mentality when you brought the 100 people together. And some things I wanted to just clarify is how did they elect the delegates? Was it by districts, or, you know, what was the mechanism to determine, you know, okay, this area will, you know, will elect one delegate, this another delegate, and then
the delegates were still elected on partisan party labels. And actually there were 5 independents eventually elected, but we all ran on our political party labels because that was mandated. It wasn't just pulled out of the air. It was mandated that we run by political parties. But when we got that orientation session and we decided to sit alphabetically, we decided that we're going to forget who is what party. And actually, toward the end of the convention, many of us did not know the political affiliation of the other delegates because we didn't care. We were interested in issues, and we discussed issues, not political party. And I have an interesting little anecdote. I don't know if I should tell it here or save it for the meeting. What do you think, Jerry?
I would say it here. They can hear it again.
Okay. It was one of the big laughs of the convention because among our women delegates was the wife of a former governor, Betty Babcock, a very wonderful lady. We just really, everybody enjoyed Betty. And she just decided to ask a provocative question quite innocently. But when we were discussing leaving out the partisan politics, she didn't like what was happening during that orientation session because the 19 women were referred by the 81 men as Madam Delegate. When they had a question for us, they'd say, Madam Delegate, Madam Delegate. And it just didn't seem right to us. And, you know, we were just delegates, we thought. And so she got up on the floor and she said, we got rid of party politics. I think we should also get rid of sex on the floor. And boy, did that elicit a lot of laughter.
It's eliciting laughter here.
Wonderful chairman, and he handled it beautifully. He was masterful. But we did get rid of sex on the floor. No more Madam Delegate. After that, our fellow delegates treated us like the other delegates who were just delegates so-and-so. And so Betty Babcock made her point. We had 19 women, and if I have time during this hour, I'd like to talk about some of those women. But in the meantime, I do think that sitting alphabetically and getting rid of the partisan politics, those were keys to working together and to just discuss issues, and we discuss them over and over and over again. And Leo Graybill was such a wonderful chairperson because he decided early on that he was never going to cut off debate. And some people said, you're going to have to cut off debate. This will go on forever. No, he said, if people want to talk, we'll stay till midnight or after. No cutting off debate. And so we could understand every issue. Now, when I serve in the legislature, I have to say, I try to keep on top of every issue. It's humanly impossible with so many bills introduced, you know. But during this Constitution Convention, we would consider and reconsider and reconsider, and everyone understood what was going on. So that was another beauty, comparing the two systems.
And I think that gets at process matters, right? That if you want to have an outcome substantively that everyone can support, right, even if they don't agree with it, that it was reached with a fair democratic process, I think it's really key. And so part of that is having leadership that takes kind of, out their positions, at least for the time, of not cutting off debate. So we had, Delegate Graybill was the leader. And then who were some of the other leaders and kind of key figures at the convention?
I'll mention certain people because there were so many. The League of Women Voters is a group. We had quite an effective group of people who were leaders. Dorothy Eck was state president of the League at that time. But I would like to talk about all of the women delegates anyhow, but as far as all the delegates, each of them played a role. We had some outstanding people and some eloquent people. And if we had time, it'd be wonderful to discuss all 100 of the delegates because they came from all walks of life and we became friends. That's the important thing.
Tell us about Leo.
He was an unusual person because he was a lawyer and he was very understanding, and there were 24 lawyers in the group. But someone won after his convention. I think that was another moment of humor. You know, this thing is all down in a verbatim transcript. If anybody wants to get the proceedings, they're at the libraries and all, verbatim transcripts. But somewhere in those proceedings, you'll hear where one of the delegates said, asked the question of Leo as the chairman, is it possible for someone to explain what the lawyers are saying after they said it? Leo said, that's an impossible task because, you know, they use legalese. But we did have some remarkable people and from all walks of life. And it's just I've been involved in a lot in my 96 years. And I have a wonderful family and personal life. And I have to say that being a part of the Constitution Convention was one of the highlights of my life. And we made friends that lasting a lifetime. And some of them I didn't agree with politically, you know, on some of their ideas. But that didn't matter. We became friends, and we had these reunions every year. They're more social than anything else. But it shows that people can disagree without being so disagreeable. That's what makes me unhappy about these times. People just can't seem to be nice to each other.
Focus on the ideas, right? So I am a big promoter of that as well, that you watch a lot of our, you know, quote, debates, and they're so ad hominem, right? They're full of attacks on people's character and slander, and it's not productive. And I love that you come together and you just focus on where you have agreement, where you have disagreement, but you focus on the substantive issues instead of focusing on sort of petty personal concerns. And I think that that's a great lesson in that you guys did that, and look at the incredible outcome that was produced with the 72 Constitution. And I want our listeners to understand also, you discussed that, you know, there's so many issues when you're doing something like writing a new constitution that no one could meaningfully address all of them. So you formed committees, and I want to talk about what was the committee process, and then tell me maybe a little bit about the committee or committees that you served on and what that was like?
Well, before the committees, Tom, it was so important that we have research done because, you know, 100 delegates from all walks of life. We were, a lot of them, of us were very involved in one thing and another, but we needed research about other states and their constitutions and their rules, and that's where the young researchers came in. Every committee was assigned a researcher. I was on the legislative committee, and Rich Bechtel was our researcher. And before the convention even started, we received all these books comparing different legislatures, because I was in the legislative committee, and that's how I learned about unicameral. But also, one of the earliest research papers we got was from one of our women delegates, the oldest delegate. Lucille Spear was a librarian at the university in Missoula, and she also was state secretary of the League of Women Voters at the time I went on the board of the League of Women Voters, and I was destined to be secretary. So Lucille was my mentor. She taught me about writing good minutes and really knowing what's going on because secretaries are important. And I knew Lucille personally. So then when she was elected as a delegate, I was thrilled. And I was even more thrilled when we were sent some research that she had done about other constitutions, even before the researchers for each committee did their job. So research was vital, because otherwise how would we know what to propose or what's going on? And so I do want to stress Dale Harris, who was the head researcher. I mean, they really played an important role in leading up to the convention.
All the research that was done, how many committees were there working on the research for you?
Well, there was a committee for every group, so I think there were 12. I don't know offhand,
okay.
I'll count them again. But every committee had a researcher assigned to it so that that researcher could answer all of our questions about specifics. I mean, we just had to know about other states and what they were doing, and we learned. And we learned to take the best from all of them.
I think we have a tendency as humans and as society to sort of, if you just don't, you know, continually renew, things just fall into disuse. And I love that, you know, one of the things that was front and center is evidence, right? That we need to understand what other folks have done, what has been successful, what has been problematic. But the key point being that we do the research, we do the work, we don't just rely on kind of intuition or our own pre-existing beliefs. And again, I think it shows what you can accomplish when you have people that come together of goodwill, of good faith, they get the information, and then they act upon accurate information. And I want to brush on, so you have these 12 committees, and would they then produce a section of the Constitution and propose it to all the delegates?
Yeah, so we had to study our own section. I'm not sure there were 12. Don't quote me on that. I have to stop and count. But I do know that every committee had its chairperson, and that's one thing that Leo did so fairly. He didn't care if you were a Republican or Democrat. I mean, he put people who were really knowledgeable on those committees. I mean, we forgot who was what, because not like the legislature now, where partisan politics is everything, the caucuses and that sort of thing. But we didn't have lobbyists. We didn't pay any attention to lobbyists. They were appalled at the very beginning. We would not go out to dinner with them. We would not go to parties that they sponsored. We just wanted nothing to do with lobbyists. And they felt that. I think it kind of hurt the lobbyists. And they're good lobbyists. They try to educate during the legislative session. But also, a lot of times, they have undue influence. And nobody could influence us. We were very independent. It was a wonderful group.
Arlene, one thing that you and I have talked about a lot, and that is, you know, the Bill of Rights was a really important part, and the preamble. So if you can tell us about both of those, those are good stories.
And the preamble, so beautiful.
I know.
Bob Campbell who was one of our youngest delegates, and Maid Ann, who was the youngest delegate, wrote the preamble. Remember, we said we had to have a preamble, and they said, well, we'll take care of it. And one cold, wintry night in January, they got together, and that preamble is beautiful. Do I have time to read it? It's short.
Yes, you do. Absolutely.
We the people of Montana, grateful to God for the quiet beauty of our state, the grandeur of our mountains, the vastness of our rolling plains, and desiring to improve the quality of life, equality of opportunity, and to secure the blessings of liberty for this and future generations, do ordain and establish this Constitution. And so when they wrote it and they ran it by the rest of us, we said, that's beautiful. And so the two youngest delegates wrote the preamble. And Maid Ann is going to be with us on the 23rd.
She sure is.
So she'll be able to speak for herself. And as far as the Declaration of Rights, you know, we have Declaration of Rights that, you know, everybody talks about the Bill of Rights and the Federal Constitution, and they are wonderful, but they leave something to be desired. For example, it doesn't spell out in the Federal Constitution the right of privacy. It's nowhere there, or the Equal Rights Amendment, or any of those things. I mean, it's just, we have our rights, but in the Montana Declaration of Rights, we've got all kinds of unusual rights. And then when we wrote the certain rights, like individual dignity, all we did was put in the word sex. So we have a Equal Rights Amendment under individual dignity, the rights of both, you know, all people. And then another one has to do with age. Children, young people didn't have many rights in our state explicitly in the Constitution. And in our Constitution, we have the rights of persons not adults, an actual right, Section 15. And so we have all kinds of rights, that right of privacy, as I mentioned, the right to know, the right of participation. Boy, that saved me. I wasn't going to talk about the bridge, but I just want to say one thing. At one point in our struggle to save the bridge, there was a committee hearing. The highway department was in charge of it. And the bridge is right in the middle of this area they were discussing. So 40 of us went there, bridge supporters, to testify. And the chairman says, you can't testify. You can't testify. This has nothing to do with the bridge. This is about the road going alongside the bridge. And I said, I was a delegate. We have a right to participate. And I argued the point. And finally he said, okay, we're not going to record it, but you can testify. So we testified at that hearing. So the right to participate was very important because the Tribune was there and they reported on that. And they wrote an editorial in support of our right to save the bridge.
I want to hear now about clean and healthful.
Oh, that's so important. Because that is a right that's not only in the Declaration of Rights, but it's also in our Natural Resources article. And when I talk about Louise Cross, she was the chairperson of our Natural Resources and Environment article. She worked so hard to get that in the article, and it was not easy. And if you get the verbatim transcript, you'll see how we had to fight to get a right in a clean, healthful environment. And Bob Campbell ultimately saved the day on that one. And if you ever get to see that documentary that PBS did for this and future generations, they cover that quite well. Bob telling about how finally, with the help of Leo Graybill, we got that right to a clean and healthful environment, not only in the Bill of Rights, but in the special Natural Resources and Environment article. It was a struggle. And so if you see that documentary, watch for it. And if you look at the proceedings, read how long that went on. So many of us fought to try to keep that in the Constitution.
And if you hear Bob Campbell's story about it, it was 11th hour or 11 and a half, wasn't it, Arlene?
Right, it was right at the very, we thought we would have to give it up. We were so sad. Yeah. And Leo says, let's give Bob a chance. And he quieted down the delegates because they were reading the paper. They weren't interested. They said, we don't want to have that. We don't want to spell it out that way. And so Bob pointed out, how are you going to feel when you go home after this convention and some kid says, what do you do about the environment? And you say, well, we've got one. Well, everybody knows we've got an environment. So that's when the delegates were persuaded somehow to insert the words clean and healthful environment. And I can't tell you how many times that's been used to save our environment in this state. The MEIC, Montana Environmental Information Center, they base all of their arguments on the provisions that are in our Constitution twice, Bill of Rights and the Natural Resources Article, the right to a clean and healthful environment. We in Montana have that.
Arlene, when I came to Montana, and it was in 1974, so it was 2 years after the convention, I knew nothing about the convention. All I ever heard about was a clean and healthful environment. No matter what environmental or conservation group, it was always the clean and healthful environment. It almost sounded like it was the whole Constitution. I mean, it is a fantastic win for Montana.
Very important.
And it is what I love when you look at the way this Constitution interacts with the federal Constitution.
Right.
Is, you know, like you talked about, the 10th Amendment, you know, you leave a lot of the kind of police powers of the government to be for the states. And I love how Montana has been able to use its constitution. It's not just a carbon copy of what's in the federal constitution, right? It actually has those provisions. And I just want to make sure we get our listeners that privacy provision is obviously very important.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, right to a clean environment, I would think, was pretty revolutionary at the time and just not seen in a lot of constitutions. Are there any other provisions that our listeners should know? I mean, us as citizens that are our rights that you think we may not be familiar with?
Well, I think they've been well publicized, but there's some that bear repeating. You know, the single-member district is very important. In our legislative committee, we managed to get, we didn't have any trouble getting that through. When we used to vote for people at large, a lot of people couldn't run because it was expensive. And now it is possible in a House district to go door to door and run. I ran for the legislature. It never cost me anything. You know, if you can have a direct contact with people, single member district. And actually this year, I think one of the important provisions that we put in our Constitution is the reapportionment commission. I don't know how many people remember, but during the legislative sessions, before we had that commission, the whole legislative session before the districting took place was taken up with fighting. The legislators would be gerrymandering and fighting the whole session about how the state was broken up into districts. It was horrible. We couldn't get anything else done, just fighting about the legislative districts. So when we set up the commission, with the fifth person being the chairperson. And I know there was a lot of time spent with it this year after the census because we still have a new district and all. But it's nothing compared to what we had to go through previous years when the whole session of the legislature was devoted to that. So that's another important. But there are so many important provisions. I don't think we have time to cover them. And it looks like I'm not going to have time to cover my women delegates.
I would love, Arlene, if we could just have one, you know, just shining example of a woman delegate that made a difference, you know, in the convention.
Well, Louise Cross was our heroine because she had that tough stand. Everybody on her committee was against the clean and healthful environment. She didn't get much cooperation, but she managed to do it. And Dorothy Eck was important as she was spearheaded the provision in the education article, which recognizes the distinct and unique cultural heritage of the American Indians. Before that, there was nothing in the Constitution. There was no recognition of the school system. And we have that in our education article. I already talked about Lucille Spear. She was very instrumental, you know, in helping. She wrote the booklet on writing a constitution before we even convened the convention. And then Maine Ann Robinson, oh, she was excellent. And Maine Ann is going to be at our presentation on the 13th, on the 23rd. I think everybody will enjoy her. She was a great delegate. Grace Bates, oh, she was a real asset to our convention. She set up the first Council of Aging in her county. She was from Amsterdam, Montana. And she was involved in every historic project in her area. And Jean Bowman, when she was served with us, I guess she had been a teacher, but she, afterwards she went to law school, became an outstanding lawyer. Daphne Bugby Jones was educated as an architect at Harvard, and she contributed much to many discussions, and she knew people, and she managed to get the Time magazine to cover our convention, and they, Time had a big feature article calling our document a model document. She was very active in the league, too. Veronica O'Sullivan was from Butte, and she was one of the most popular delegates, and her brother was a priest, and he came to all of our meetings. Oh, Katie Payne was an interesting one. She was a judge before becoming a delegate. She served on the local government committee. She was married to the professor, Tom Payne, and unfortunately, Katie died. Catherine Pemberton was the newspaper publisher. She had ran an independent newspaper. I mean, we had some outstanding women, and she was really active with the Public Information Committee. Edith Van Buskirk was born in Havre, and she was really active in her community and church. And she won, when she was in college at Northern Montana, they won the Montana State Debate Championship. And Lynn Sparks was our young, one, another young delegate. She was very beautiful, but I'm afraid her claim to fame was she never said one word during the convention. We used to tease her about that.
So she was not a spark.
And then I have to mention Rachel Mansfield. She was a relative of Mike Mansfield, distant, and she had a fascinating life. She was in military service in the Waves. She was a teacher and an author, and she had been, I knew her early on before the convention. She was state president of PTA, and I was the local president. She was very dynamic, and she was a very active member of the Bill of Rights Committee. Marjorie Kane was born in Miles City in 1915. She graduated from college, though, in California, and she taught there. And then later she taught in Montana, very active in Libby politics. She reorganized the BPW, served on the Red Cross Board, elected city council. And so Virginia Blend, our own Great Falls delegate, she was remarkable. And her family, she and her husband started Blend's Coffee Shop, but her influence was very strong because one of our most progressive, innovative provisions is in the local government article, because there we have a provision that every 10 years, local government has to look at itself, and there's on the election, on the ballot, is a question, do you want a study commission? I know because I served on one of those study commissions, but that was a very important progressive, you know, movement for looking at local governments. As a result, some governments were consolidated, like Butte and Silver Bow, and Deer Lodge, Anaconda. Anyhow, Margaret Warden is one I have to mention. She was on the library board here, and she was worked nationally for libraries. She received national recognition for all her efforts on behalf of libraries. And she even influenced one piece of legislation when they were going to leave libraries off of this education article. She insisted that libraries be included, and it's still there. And Marion Erdman was our local governor, our local mayor, and she handled that role very well because she had been part of Great Falls local government.
The takeaway I have from this one is that we stand on the shoulders of giants, right? When you just think of the amount of talent and kind of roll up your sleeves and get it done, right? And what we saw happen. And so I want to make sure we get that once you have the Constitution and the convention has voted, there was a ratification process that was a mountain to climb in and of itself. So could you talk about, once the Constitution has been agreed on by the convention, what happened next?
Oh, it was touch and go because, you know, we were really worried about whether it would pass. And in the rural areas, it didn't. In the urban areas, it did. But as far as working toward the passage, we were supposed to get some money because we gave money back to the state. We wrote the Constitution in 54 days instead of 60. And so we gave money back to the state, which is unheard of. But when we needed money for education for the voters, you know, to vote for this, they said, you can't have any money. No money. You're going to have to finance it yourselves. So that's what we did. We got together, and many of us traveled. I know I remember traveling with Wade DeHood and others to different places in the state because I had done some television work as a legislative reporter. And Margaret Warden, who's the information person, she's another one who did this. We went all over the state trying to convince people to vote for the Constitution. And it really, I guess, we just squeaked by, so I think it must have helped. Otherwise, it might not have passed, but we had to devote our own time and our own money and our own efforts to go and persuade people to vote for the Constitution, because we didn't get any money that we were supposed to get. Somehow, the powers that be in the legislature said, no, no money.
And Arlene, my understanding is that it passed 50.2%.
Well, it was really close. I think it was
very
a difference
close.
Of 3,000 votes.
Yeah.
I think 116 to 113,000. It was 3,000 vote difference. So we just squeaked by. And then it was a fight, you know, with the Supreme Court and Leo. And it was a mess. But ultimately, we did it. So all's well that ends.
And I always like to know that is such a close margin. What were the arguments against the Constitution?
Well, mostly in rural. I think the rural people were afraid that they were going to lose power because they kind of liked the status quo. And the Farmers Union was all for the Constitution, but the Farm Bureau was not. It was a matter of politics again. And they didn't want that kind of change. They just felt that, too much change is not good. They like the status quo. And mostly that was the problem. But the urban people really liked the Constitution, and overwhelmingly, and even with the sub-options, that was proven. You know, we had the three sub-options. And
okay.
The urban people really... even voted for the unicameral as opposed to the bicameral, but the urban voted overwhelmingly against that kind of a change.
Arlene, tell about the sub-options and how important they were in the passage of it.
The three sub-options. Well, we decided in our wisdom that we didn't want to put anything controversial into the body of the Constitution, because then we could lose the whole thing. And so we had... capital punishment, which was very controversial, and our five ministers really were against capital punishment. But a lot of the people were for capital punishment. So we put that as a sub-option. And the second one was gambling. A lot of people, including Reverend Harper, a minister, very opposed to having gambling permitted in the Constitution. And we put it as a sub-option. And really wanted gambling, but in order to get gambling, they had to vote for the Constitution too. So some people say you're lucky you had that as a sub option, because in order to get any of the sub options, first the Constitution had to pass. But anyhow, the third one was unicameral, and you know, as a legislative committee member, that was kind of my baby, because I have studied Nebraska and Senator Norris and how he got that unicameral going. And to me, Montana was a natural for unicameral with our small population and just having one house and really knowing what's going on. But I realized toward the end of the convention, even though the delegates voted at one point 60-40 in favor of unicameral over bicameral in the body of the Constitution, we decided in our wisdom that if we put unicameral in the Constitution body, we would lose the whole thing. And so I was one of those who led the movement to make it a sub-option. And fortunately that happened, because we lost the unicameral, and we might have lost the whole Constitution had it been written in to this way we got the bicameral. But I could go on and on with this Constitution. Didn't even cover the fact that we had annual sessions. We had it for 2 years, and then the people passed an amendment to go back to the every 2 years, and that was disheartening. And another thing we have in the, you know, simple rule changes. We talked earlier, Tom, about this alphabetical seating. Do you know how the legislature could do that now? They don't have to do anything but make a rule. And Carla Gray, who was our Chief Justice of the Montana Supreme Court, worked diligently. She, the last years of her life, and she used to contact me often. She said, why the heck can't the legislature sit alphabetically? And a lot of people said, that's a great idea. Then we could discuss issues and not worry about this party politics. But no. But simple rule change. And another rule change that we thought, well, why don't we just reduce the size of the legislature? Why do we have 150 legislators where California, I think, has 120 with their millions of people? And we have a simple rule change that could be initiated in our Constitution as it's written today. The legislature can decide that instead of having 150 members, we can get by with 120, 80 in the House and 40 in the Senate instead of 100 in the House and 50. All they have to do is set a rule, but they're not going to do it to themselves. You know?
Well, I love, there's so many threads that you've touched on that run through our politics from the beginning.
Yeah.
The, you know, the sort of conservative versus liberal, right, is that the conservative, and they both, I think, have valid points, right? A great book that I've read is this Thomas Paine, Edmund Burke, and the Birth of Left and Right. And you need both, right? One is saying, hey, we need the new. And the other, you know, kind of says, whoa, we've got all these traditions and practices, and it's difficult to know what will happen if we sort of upset the apple cart. And I love seeing that balance. And then I thought you made a great point on the sort of horse trading issue around the subparts that, you know, well, we'll get Butte because they got to have gambling. And it's a very interesting thing we see in our politics today of, well, you want to be able to kind of offer what would be considered pork barrel to get people on board and to compromise, right? So I always think it's funny when you see things like that in action. And then I love...
Well, you're right, Tom. You're right. Politics is the art of compromise, I think. But there's no compromise these days. It's my way or the highway, you know. And that's why we don't get anything done.
Absolutely. And then I love also the element of efficiency versus representation. That
right.
You can see that if we have fewer folks, we can really delve into the issues. And then you'll have other folks that'll say, well, whoa, wait a minute. We're not going to have our constituencies properly represented. And I think wherever you fall, and I love your mentality on that, that, you know, I was a big proponent of unicameral. We ended up now, you know, with the House and Senate. But it does affect just bringing these issues up and discussing the pros and cons in a meaningful way. Having that debate, I think, is very important. And so the whole process that you did for this has been fascinating. And we are kind of running out of time, and I want to give Jerry a chance to wrap up. But I do want to ask you one last thing, Arlene, and you've gotten on this, but just to really center it for our listeners, if there are three things that you have learned in your life serving our state and our community and our country that you want to highlight for our listeners, what would those be?
Most important thing is to just accept your fellow human being as a person. Don't attach all these limits to your friendship, whether it's politics or religion or anything. I mean, accept people as people. And that's why we're having so much trouble with race, with religion, with politics. I think that we've lost sight of that in this country. We just kind of label people. And once you label them, they're on the other side. Forget about it. You know, I don't like that.
No, I think that's a great, just key message. And so, Jerry, I want to just, can you remind our listeners and kind of just go over again what we're going to have at this event on the 23rd?
I certainly can. Yes. February 23rd, it's a Wednesday evening. It starts at 6. Come on a little bit early. Go to GreatFallsRisingMT.org, and you can get all the information about the evening. It will be about the 1972 Constitutional Convention. We will have a number of delegates as well as people who are doing research and so forth. And it's going to be a wonderful evening. If you are not on the email list of Great Falls Rising and you would like to be, again, go to GreatFallsRisingMT.org and give your name and email address and phone number. And we'd love to have you get our messages. So we hope that people will come and listen, because this was a seminal moment in Montana history and continues to be. So we hope that you love this part of history in Montana. And if you don't know much about it, or even if you do, come and join us that evening.
This has been an honor and a privilege. And I do to our listeners, they say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So make sure to come out on February 23rd, and it's on Zoom, and find out about what our forebears have passed on to us and how they did it, and the lessons it holds for us today.
Right, and the link for the Zoom will be on the website.
So absolutely check it out, and I want to just, I feel so honored and privileged, Jerry and Arlene, to have had you guys on today. Thank you so much for coming on Voices and Views.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That was Arlene Reichert, the Bridge Lady, and today the Montana Constitution Lady, and Jerry Jennings, community activist. Thank you so much for tuning in to Voices and Views.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like more information about KGPR, please visit our website, kgpr.org, where you can find a link to donate, links to all of our other locally produced programming, and information about your local voice, KGPR, Great Falls.